time it was accepted without resistance. He watched Zacharias take a long pull before handing it back. "So just how good is this new one?"
"The MiG-25. It's a rocket," Grishinov told him enthusiastically. "It probably turns even worse than your thud, but for straight-line speed you have no fighter close to it. 4 missiles, no gun. The radar is the most powerful ever made for a fighter, and it cannot be jammed."
"Short range?" Zacharias asked.
"About 40 kilometers," the Russian nodded. "We give away range for reliability. We tried to get both, but failed."
"Hard for us, too," the American acknowledged with a grunt.
"You know, I do not expect a war between my country and yours. Truly, I do not. We have little that you might wish to take away. What we have, resources, space, land, all these things you have. But the Chinese," he said, "they need these things, and they share a border with us. And we gave them the weapons that they will use against us. And there are so many of them. Little, evil people like these here, but so many more."
"So what are you going to do about it?"
Grishinov shrugged. "I will command my regiment. I will plan to defend the motherland against a nuclear attack from China. I just haven't decided how yet."
"It's not easy. It helps if you have space and time to play with, and the right people to play against."
"We have bomber people, but nothing like yours. You know, even without resistance, I doubt we could place as many as 20 bombers over your country. They're all based 2,000 kilometers from where I will be. You know what that means? Nobody even to train against."
"You mean a red team?"
"We would call it a blue team, Robin. I hope you understand." Grishinov chuckled, then turned serious again. "But yes, it will all be theoretical. Or some fighters will pretend to be bombers, but their endurance is too short for a proper exercise."
"This is all on the level?"
"Robin, I will not ask you to trust me. That is too much. You know that, and so do I. Ask yourself, do you really think your country will ever make war on my country?"
"Probably not," Zacharias admitted.
"Have I asked you about your war plans?"
"Yes, certainly they are most interesting theoretical exercises, and I would probably find them fascinating war games. But have I asked about them?"
His voice was that of a patient teacher.
"No, you haven't, Kolya, that's true.
Robin, I am not worried about B-52s. I am worried about Chinese bombers. That is the war my country is preparing for."
He looked down at the concrete floor, puffing on a cigarette and going on softly. "I remember when I was 11. The Germans were within 100 kilometers of Moscow. My father joined his transport regiment. They made it up from university teachers. Half of them never came back. My mother and I evacuated the city, east to some little village whose name I can't remember. It was so confusing then, so dark all the time. Worrying about my father, a professor of history, driving a truck. We lost 20 million citizens to the Germans, Robin. 20 million. People I knew. The fathers of friends. My wife's father died in the war. 2 of my uncles died. When I went through the snow with my mother, I promised myself that someday I would defend my country too. And so I am a fighter pilot. I do not invade. I do not attack. I defend. Do you understand this thing I tell you, Robin? My job is to protect my country so that other little boys will not have to run away from home in the middle of winter. Some of my classmates died, it was so cold. That is why I defend my country. The Germans wanted what we had, and now the Chinese want it too. He waved towards the door of the cell. People like that. Even before Zacharias spoke, Kolya knew he had him. Months of work for this moment, Grishinov thought, like seducing a virgin, but much sadder. This man would never see his home again. The Vietnamese had every intention of killing these men when their utility ended. It was such a colossal waste of talent, and his antipathy to his supposed allies was every bit as real as he feigned it to be. It was no longer pretense. From the first moment he'd arrived in Hanoi, seeing firsthand their arrogant superiority and their incredible cruelty and their stupidity, he had just achieved more with kind words and not even a liter of vodka than what they and their torturers had failed to do with years of mindless venom. Instead of inflicting pain, he had shared it. Instead of abusing the man beside him, he had given kindness, respecting his virtues, assuaging his injuries as best he could, protecting him from more, and bitterly regretting that he'd necessarily been the agent of the most recent of them. There was a downside, however. To achieve this breakthrough, he'd opened his soul, told true stories, dredged up his own childhood nightmares, re-examined his true reason for joining the profession he loved. Only possible, only thinkable, because he'd known that the man sitting next to him was doomed to a lonely, unknown death. Already dead to his family and his country, and an unattended grave. This man was no fascist, Hitlerite. He was an enemy, but a straightforward one, who had probably done his utmost to spare harm to non-combatants, because he too had a family. There was in him no illusion of racial superiority, not even hatred for the North Vietnamese. And that was the most remarkable thing of all, for he, Grishinov, was learning to hate them. Zacharias didn't deserve to die, Grishinov told himself, recognizing the greatest irony of all. Kolya Grishinov and Robin Zacharias were now friends. "How does this grab you?" Douglas asked, setting it on Ryan's desk. The wine bottle was in a clear plastic bag, and the smooth, clear surface was uniformly coated with a fine yellow dust. "No prints?" Emmett looked it over in considerable surprise. "Not even a smudge, Em. Zilch." The knife came down next. It was a simple switchblade, also dusted and bagged. "Smudges here. One partial thumbprint matched with the victim. Nothing else we can use but smudges, uniform smudges," the Prince Department says. "Either he stabbed himself in the back of the neck, or our suspect was wearing gloves." It was awfully warm this time of the year to wear gloves. Emmett Ryan leaned back, staring at the evidence items on his desk, then at Tom Douglas, sitting beside them. "Okay, Tom, go on." "We've had 4 murder scenes, a total of 6 victims. No evidence left behind. 5 of the victims, 3 incidents, are pushers, 2 different M.O.s. But in every case, no witnesses. Roughly the same time of day, all within a 5-block radius." "Craftsmanship." Lieutenant Ryan nodded. He closed his eyes, first mentally viewing the different crime scenes, then correlating the data. "Rob, not Rob, change M.O. But the last one did have a witness." "Go home, ma'am." "Why was he polite?" Ryan shook his head. "Real life isn't Agatha Christie, Tom. Our young lad today, Em. Tell me about the method our friend used to dispatch him." "Knife there. I haven't seen anything like that in a long time. Strong son of a bitch. I did see one, back in 58 or 59. Ryan paused, collecting his thoughts. "A plumber, I think. Big, tough guy. Found his wife in bed with somebody. He let the man live, then he took a chisel, held her head up. You have to be really pissed off to do it the hard way. Anger, right?" "Why do it that way?" Douglas asked. "You can cut a throat a lot easier, and the victim is just as dead." "A lot messier, too. Noisy." Ryan's voice trailed off as he thought it through. It was not appreciated that people with their throats cut made a great deal of noise. If you opened the windpipe, there could be the most awful gurgling sound, and if not, people screamed their way to death. Then there was the blood, so much of it, flying like water from a cut hose, getting on your hands and clothes. On the other hand, if you wanted to kill someone in a hurry, like turning off a light switch, and if you were strong and had him crippled already, the base of the skull, where the spinal cord joined the brain, was just the perfect spot, quick, quiet, and relatively clean. The two pushers were a couple blocks away, time of death almost identical. Our friend does them, walks over this way, turns a corner, and sees Mrs. Charles being hassled. Lieutenant Ryan shook his head. Why not just keep going? Cross the street, that's the smart move. Why get involved? A killer with morals? Ryan asked. That was where the theory broke down. And if the same guy is wasting pushers, what's the motive? Except for the two last night, it looks like robbery. Maybe with those two something spooked him off before he could collect the money and the drugs. A car going down the street, some noise. If we're dealing with a robber, then it doesn't connect with Mrs. Charles and her friend. Tom, it's just speculation. Four separate incidents, no physical evidence, a guy wearing gloves, a street wino wearing gloves. Not enough, Tom. I'm going to have Western District start shaking them down anyway. Ryan nodded. That was fair enough. It was midnight when he left his apartment. The area was so agreeably quiet on a weekday night. The old apartment complex was peopled with residents who minded their own business. Kelly had not so much as shaken a hand since the manager's. A few friendly nods, that was all. There were no children in the complex, just middle-aged people, almost all married couples, sprinkled with a few widowed singles. Mainly white-collar workers, a surprising number of whom rode the bus to work downtown, watched TV at night, heading to bed around 10 or 11. Kelly moved out quietly, driving the VW down Lock Raven Boulevard, past churches and other apartment complexes, past the city's sports stadium as the neighborhoods evolved downward from middle to working class, and from working class to subsistence, passing darkened office buildings downtown in his continuing routine. But tonight, there was a difference. Tonight would be his first major payoff. That meant risk, but it always did, Kelly told himself, flexing his hands on the plastic steering wheel. He didn't like the surgical gloves. The rubber held heat in, and though the sweat didn't affect his grip, the discomfort was annoying. The alternative was not acceptable, however, and he remembered not liking a lot of things he'd done in Vietnam, like the leeches, a thought that generated a few chills. They were even worse than rats. At least rats didn't suck your blood. Kelly took his time driving around his objective almost randomly while he sized things up. It paid off. He saw a pair of police officers talking to a street bum, one of them close, the other two steps back, seemingly casual, but the distance between the two cops told him what he needed to know. One was covering the other. They saw the wino as someone potentially threatening. "Looking for you, Johnny boy," he told himself, turning the wheel and changing streets. But the cops wouldn't change their whole operating routine, would they? Looking at and talking to winos would be an additional duty for the next few nights. There were other things that had higher priority. Answering calls for hold-up alarms in liquor stores, responding to family disputes, even traffic violations. No, hassling drunks would just be one more burden on men already overworked. It would be something with which to spice up their normal patrol patterns, and Kelly had troubled himself to learn what those patterns were. The additional danger was therefore somewhat predictable, and Kelly reasoned that he'd had his supply of bad luck for this mission. Just one more time and he'd switch patterns. To what, he didn't know. But if things went right, what he should soon learn would provide the necessary information. "Thank you," he said to Destiny, a block away from the corner brownstone. The Roadrunner was right there, and it was early still, a collection night. The girl wouldn't be there. He drove past it, continuing up the next block before turning right, then another block and right again. He saw a police cruiser and checked the clock on the car. It was within 5 minutes of its normal schedule, and this one was a solo car. There wouldn't be another pass for about 2 hours, Kelly told himself, making a final right turn and heading towards the brownstone. He parked as close to it as he dared, then got out and walked away from the target house, heading back to the next block before dropping into his disguise. There were two pushers on this block, both lone operators. They looked a little tense. Perhaps the word was getting out, Kelly thought with a suppressed smile. Some of their brethren were disappearing, and that had to be cause for concern. He kept well clear of both as he covered the block, inwardly amused that neither knew how close death had passed them. How tenuous their lives were, and yet they didn't know. But that was a distraction, he told himself, turning yet again and heading to the objective. He paused at the corner, looking around. It was after 1 in the morning now, and things were settling down into the accustomed boredom that comes at the end of any working day, even the illegal kind. Activity on the street was diminishing, just as expected from all the reconnaissance he had done. There was nothing untoward on this street, and Kelly headed south past the rows of brownstones on one side of the street and brick row houses on the other. It required all of his concentration to maintain his uneven, harmless gait. One of those who had hurt Pam was now within 100 yards, probably 2 of them. Kelly allowed his mind to see her face again, to hear her voice, to feel the curves of her body. He allowed his face to become a frozen mask of stone and his hands to ball into tight fists as his legs shambled down the wide sidewalk, but only for a few seconds. Then he cleared his mind and took 5 deep, slow breaths. Tactical, he murmured to himself, slowing his pace and watching the corner house, now only 30 yards away. Kelly took in a mouthful of wine and let it dribble down on his shirt again. Snake to Chicago, objective in sight. Moving in now. The sentry, if that's what he was, betrayed himself. The street lights revealed puffs of cigarette smoke coming out the door, telling Kelly exactly where the first target was. He switched the wine bottle to his left hand and flexed his right one, turning his wrist around to make sure his muscles were loose and ready. Approaching the wide steps, he slumped against them, coughing. Then he walked up towards the door, which he knew to be ajar, and fell against it. Kelly tumbled to the floor, finding himself at the feet of the man whom he'd seen accompany Billy. Along the way, the wine bottle broke, and Kelly ignored the man, whimpering over the broken glass and spreading stain of cheap California red. "That's tough luck, partner," a voice said. It was surprisingly gentle. "You best move along now." Kelly just continued his whimpering, down on all fours, weaving on them. He coughed a little more, turning his head to see the sentry's legs and shoes, confirming his identification. "Come on, Pop." Strong hands reached down, both hands lifting him. Kelly allowed his own arms to dangle, one going behind as the man started to turn him towards the door. He staggered, turning yet more, and now the sentry was supporting him almost fully. Weeks of training and preparation and careful reconnaissance came together in a single instant. Kelly's left hand slapped against his face. The right drove the K-bar through the ribs, and so alert were his senses that his fingertips could feel the heart, trying to beat, but only destroying itself on the razor-sharp, double-edged blade of the fighting knife. Kelly twisted the blade, leaving it in as the body shuddered. The dark eyes were wide and shocked, and the knees already buckling. Kelly let him down slowly, quietly, still holding the knife. But he had to allow himself a bit of satisfaction this time. He'd worked too hard for this moment to turn his emotions off completely. "Remember Pam?" he whispered to the dying body in his hands, and for the question he received his satisfaction. There was recognition through the pain before the eyes rolled back. "Snake." Kelly waited, counting to 60 before he withdrew the knife, which he wiped off on the victim's shirt. It was a good knife, and it didn't deserve to be stained with that kind of blood. Kelly rested himself for a moment, breathing deeply. He'd gotten the right target, the subordinate. The principal objective was upstairs. Everything was going according to plan. He allowed himself exactly 1 minute to calm down and collect himself. The stairs were creaky. Kelly attenuated that by keeping close to the wall, minimizing the displacement of the wooden treads, moving very slowly, eyes locked upwards because there was nothing below to concern him now. He had already replaced the knife in its scabbard. His .45/22 was in his right hand now, suppressor screwed on, held low in his right hand as the left traced the cracked plaster wall. Halfway up, he started hearing sounds other than that of the blood coursing through his arteries. A slap, a whimper, a whine. Distant animal sounds, followed by a cruel chuckle, barely audible even as he reached the landing and turned left towards their source. Breathing next, heavy, rapid, and slow. Oh, shit. But he couldn't stop now.
Please.
A despairing whisper that caused Kelly's knuckles to turn white around the pistol grip. He moved along the upstairs corridor slowly, again rubbing up against the wall. There was light coming from the master bedroom, only the illumination from streetlights through dirty windows, but with his eyes adjusted to darkness, he could see shadows on one wall.
"What's the matter, Dor?" a male voice asked as Kelly reached the doorframe.
Very slowly he moved his head around the vertical barrier of painted wood. There was a mattress in the room, and on the mattress a woman, kneeling, head down while a hand roughly squeezed her breast, then shook it. Kelly watched her mouth open in silent pain, remembering the photo that the detective had shown him. "You did that to Pam, too, didn't you, you little fuck?" Liquid dripped from the girl's face, and the face staring down at her was smiling when Kelly took a step into the room. His voice was light, relaxed, almost comical. "This looks like fun. Can I play, too?" Billy turned, looking at the shadow that had just spoken, and saw an extended arm with a big automatic. The face turned back to a pile of clothing and a carry bag of some sort. The rest of him was naked, and his left hand held a tool of some sort, but not a knife or a gun. Those tools were elsewhere, 10 feet away, and his eyes could not bring them closer. "Don't even think it, Billy," Kelly said in a conversational tone.
"Who the fuck?"
"On your face, spread eagle, or I'll shoot that little dick of yours right off." Kelly altered his aim. It was amazing how much importance men placed on that organ, how easily a threat to it intimidated. Not even a serious threat, what with its size. The brain was much larger and easier to hit. "Down! Now!" Billy did what he was told. Kelly pushed the girl back on the mattress and reached in his belt for the electrical wire. In a few seconds, the hands were securely wrapped and knotted. The left hand still held a pair of pliers, which Kelly took and used to tighten the wire yet more, drawing a gasp from Billy.
"Pliers? Jesus!"
The girl was staring at his face, eyes wide, breath heavy, but her movements were slow and her head was tilted. She was drugged to some extent, and she had seen his face, was looking at it now, memorizing it.
"Why do you have to be here? This is out of the pattern. You're a complication. I ought to...
If you do that, John, then what the fuck are you?"
"Oh, shit."
Kelly's hands started shaking then. This was real danger. If he let her live, then someone would know who he was. A description, enough to start a proper manhunt, and that would, might, prevent him from accomplishing his goal. But the greater danger was to his soul. If he killed her, that was lost forever. Of that he was certain. Kelly closed his eyes and shook his head. Everything was supposed to have gone so smoothly.
"Shit happens, Johnny boy."
"Get dressed," he told her, tossing some stuff in her direction. "Do it now. Be quiet, and stay there."
"Who are you?" Billy asked,
giving Kelly an outlet for his rage. The distributor felt something cold and round at the back of his head. "You even breathe loud, and your brains go on this floor, got it?" The head nodded by way of an answer. Now what the hell do I do? Kelly demanded of himself. He looked over at the girl, struggling to put panties on. The light caught her breasts, and Kelly's stomach revolted at the marks he saw there. Hurry up, he told her. Damn, damn, damn. Kelly checked the wire on Billy's wrists and decided to do another loop at the elbows, hurting him badly, straining the shoulders, but ensuring that he wouldn't be doing any resisting. To make things worse, he lifted Billy by the arms to a standing position, which evoked a scream. Hurt a little, does it? Kelly asked. Then he applied a gag and turned him to the door. Walk. To the girl. You too. Kelly conducted them down the steps. There was some broken glass, and Billy's feet danced around it, sustaining cuts. What surprised Kelly was the girl's reaction to the body at the bottom. Rick! She gasped, then stooped down to touch the body. It had a name, Kelly thought, lifting the girl. Out the back. He stopped them at the kitchen, leaving them alone for an instant and looking out the back door. He could see his car, and there was no activity in his view. There was danger in what came next, but danger had again become his companion. Kelly led them out. The girl was looking at Billy, and he at her, motioning with his eyes. Kelly was dumbfounded to see that she was reacting to his silent entreaties. He took her arm and moved her aside. Don't worry about him, miss. He pointed her to the car, maneuvering Billy by the upper arm. A distant voice told him that if she tried to help Billy, then he would have an excuse to... No, goddammit. Kelly unlocked the door, forcing Billy in, then the girl into the front seat, before moving fast to the left side door. Before starting the car, he leaned over the seat and wired up Billy's ankles and knees. "Who are you?" the girl asked as the car started moving. "A friend," Kelly said calmly. "I am not going to hurt you. If I wanted to do that, I could have left you with Rick, okay?" Her reply was slow and uneven, but for all that, still amazing to Kelly. "Why did you have to kill him? He was nice to me." "What the hell?" Kelly thought, looking over at her. Her face was scraped, her hair a mess. He turned his eyes back to the street. A police cruiser went past on a reciprocal heading, and, despite a brief moment of panic on Kelly's part, it just kept going, disappearing as he turned north. Think fast, boy. Kelly could have done many things, but only one alternative was realistic. Realistic? He asked himself. Oh, sure. One does not expect to hear doorbells at 3:15 in the morning. Sandy first thought she had dreamed it, but her eyes had opened, and in the way of the mind, the sound played back to her as though she had actually awakened a second earlier. Even so, she must have dreamed it, the nurse told herself, shaking her head. She'd just started to close her eyes again when it repeated. Sandy rose, slipped on a robe, and went downstairs, too disoriented to be frightened. There was a shape on the porch. She turned on the lights as she opened the door.
"Turn that fucking light off!"
A rasping voice that was nonetheless familiar. The command it carried caused her to flip the switch without so much as a thought. "What are you doing here?" There was a girl at his side looking thoroughly horrible. "Call in sick. You're not going to work today. You're going to take care of her. Her name is Doris," Kelly said, speaking in the low, commanding tone of a surgeon in the middle of a complex procedure.
"Wait a minute."
Sandy stood erect and her mind started racing. Kelly was wearing a woman's wig. Well, too dirty for that. He was unshaven, had on awful clothes, but his eyes were burning with something. Rage was part of it, a fury at something, and the man's strong hands were shaking at his side. "Remember about Pam?" he asked urgently.
"Well, yes, but this girl's in the same spot.
I can't help her, not now. I have to do something else."
"What are you doing, John?" Sandy asked, a different sort of urgency in her voice.
And then, somehow, it was very clear. The TV news reports she'd been watching over dinner on the black-and-white set in the kitchen, the look she'd seen in his eyes in the hospital, the look she saw now, so close to the other, but different, a desperate compassion and the trust it demanded of her. "Somebody's been beating the shit out of her, Sandy. She needs help."
"John," she whispered, John, you're putting your life in my hands.
Kelly actually laughed after a fashion, a bleak snort that went beyond irony.
Yeah, well, you did okay the first time, didn't you?
He pushed Doris in the door and walked away, off to a car, without looking back.
I'm going to be sick, the girl, Doris, said.
Sandy hustled her to the first-floor bathroom and got her to the toilet in time. The young woman knelt there for a minute or two, emptying her belly into the white porcelain bowl. After another minute or so, she looked up. In the glare of incandescent lights off the white tile walls, Sandra O'Toole saw the face of hell.
Chapter 20 Depressurization. It was after 4 when Kelly pulled into the marina. He backed the scout to the transom of his boat and got out to open the cargo hatch after checking the darkness for spectators, of which, thankfully, there were none. Hop, he told Billy, and that he did. Kelly pushed him aboard, then directed him into the main salon. Once there, Kelly got some shackles, regular marine hardware, and fastened Billy's wrists to a deck fitting. 10 minutes more and he had cast off, heading out to the bay, and finally Kelly allowed himself to relax. With the boat on autopilot, he loosed the wires on Billy's arms and legs. Kelly was tired. Moving Billy from the back of the VW into the scout had been harder than he'd expected. And at that he'd been lucky to miss the newspaper distributor, dumping his bundles on street corners for the paper boy to unwrap and deliver before 6. He settled back into the control chair, drinking some coffee and stretching by way of reward to his body for its efforts. Kelly had the lights turned way down so that he could navigate without being blinded by the internal glow of the salon. Off to port were a half dozen cargo ships tied up at Dundalk Marine Terminal, but very little in his sight was moving. There was always something relaxing about the water at a time like this. The winds were calm, and the surface a gently undulating mirror that danced with lights on the shore. Red and green lights from buoys blinked on and off while telling ships to stay out of dangerous shallows. Springer passed by Fort Carroll, a low octagon of gray stone, built by First Lieutenant Robert E. Lee, U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. It had held 12-inch rifles as recently as 60 years before. The orange fires of the Bethlehem Steel Sparrows Point Works glowed to the north. Tugboats were starting to move out of their basins to help various ships out of their berths, or to help bring new ones alongside, and their diesels growled across the flat surface in a distant, friendly way. Somehow that noise only emphasized the pre-dawn peace. The quiet was overwhelmingly comforting, just as things should be in preparation for the start of a new day. "Who the fuck are you?" Billy asked, relieved of his gag and unable to bear the silence. His arms were still behind him, but his legs were free, and he sat up on the deck of the salon. Kelly sipped his coffee, allowing his tired arms to relax and ignoring the noise behind him. "I said, who the fuck are you?" Billy called more loudly. It was going to be a warm one. The sky was clear. There were plenty of stars visible, with not even a hint of gathering clouds. No red sky at morning to cause Kelly concern. But the outside temperature had dipped only to 77, and that boded ill for the coming day, with the hot August sun to beat down on things. "Look, asshole, I want to know who the fuck you are!" Kelly shifted a little in the wide control chair, taking another sip of his coffee. His compass course was 121, keeping to the southern edge of the shipping channel, as was his custom. A brightly lit tug was coming in, probably from Norfolk, towing a pair of barges. But it was too dark to see what sort of cargo they bore. Kelly checked the lights and saw that they were properly displayed. That would please the Coast Guard, which wasn't always happy with the way the local tugs operated. Kelly wondered what sort of life it was, moving barges up and down the bay. Had to be awfully dull doing the same thing, day in and day out, back and forth, north and south, at a steady 6 knots, seeing the same things all the time. It paid well, of course. A master and a mate, and an engineer and a cook. They had to have a cook. Maybe a deckhand or two. Kelly wasn't sure about that. All taking down union wages, which were pretty decent.
Hey, okay, I don't know what the problem is, but we can talk about it, okay?
The maneuvering in close was probably pretty tricky, though, especially in any kind of wind. The barges had to be unhandy things to bring alongside. But not today. Today it wouldn't be windy. Just hotter than hell. Kelly started his turn south as he passed Bodkin Point, and he could see the red lights blinking on the towers of the Bay Bridge at Annapolis. The first glow of dawn was decorating the eastern horizon. It was kind of sad, really. The last 2 hours before sunrise were the best time of the day, but something that few ever bothered to appreciate. Just one more case of people who never knew what was going on around them. Kelly thought he saw something, but the glass windshield interfered with visibility, and so he left the control station and went topside. There he lifted his Marine 7x50s, and then the microphone of his radio. Motor yacht Springer calling Coast Guard 41 boat, over.
This is Coast Guard Springer. Portagee here. What are you doing up so early, Kelly? Over.
Carrying out my commerce on the sea, Areza. What's your excuse? Over.
Looking out for feather merchants like you to rescue. Getting some training done. What do you think? Over.
Glad to hear that, Coast Guard. You push those lever things towards the front of the boat. That's the pointy part, usually, and she goes faster. And the pointy part goes the same way you turn the wheel. You know, left to go left, right to go right. Over.
Kelly could hear the laughter over the FM circuit.
Roger, copy that, Springer. I will pass that along to my crew. Thank you, sir, for the advice. Over.
The crew on the 41-foot boat was howling after a long 8 hours of patrol, and doing very little. Areza was letting a young seaman handle the wheel, leaning on the wheelhouse bulkhead and sipping his own coffee as he played with the radio mic.
You know, Springer, I don't take that sort of guff off many guys. Over.
A good sailor respects his betters, Coast Guard.
Hey, is it true your boats have wheels on the bottom? Over.
Ooh, observed a new apprentice.
Ah, that's a negative, Springer. We take the training wheels off after the Navy pukes leave the shipyard. We don't like it when you ladies get seasick just from looking at them. Over.
Kelly chuckled and altered course to port to stay well clear of the small cutter.
Nice to know that our country's waterways are in such capable hands, Coast Guard, especially with a weekend coming up.
Careful, Springer, or I'll hit you for a safety inspection.
My federal tax money at work?
I hate to see it wasted.
Well, Coast Guard, just wanted to make sure you all were awake.
Roger, and thank you very much, sir. We were dozing a little. Nice to know we have real pros like you out here to keep us on our toes.
Fair winds, Portagee.
And to you, Kelly. Out.
The radio frequency returned to the usual static. And that took care of that, Kelly thought. It wouldn't do to have him come alongside for a chat, not just now. Kelly secured the radio and went below. The eastern horizon was pink-orange now, another 10 minutes or so until the sun made its appearance.
What was that all about? Billy asked.
Kelly poured himself another cup of coffee and checked the autopilot. It was warm enough now that he removed his shirt. The scars on his back from the shotgun blast could hardly have been more clear, even in the dim light of a breaking dawn. There was a remarkable long silence, punctuated by a deep intake of breath.
"You're..."
This time Kelly turned, looking down at the naked man chained to the deck.
"That's right."
"I killed you," Billy objected.
He'd never gotten the word. Henry hadn't passed it along, deeming it to be irrelevant to his operation.
"Think so?" Kelly asked, looking forward again.
One of the diesels was running a little warmer than the other, and he made a note to check the cooling system after his other business was done. Otherwise, the boat was behaving as docilely as ever, rocking gently on the almost invisible swells, moving along at a steady 20 knots, the bow pitched up at about 15 degrees on an efficient planing angle. on the step, as Kelly called it. He stretched again, flexing muscles, letting Billy see the scars and what lay under them.
So that's what it's about. She told us all about you before we snuffed her.
Kelly scanned the instrument panel, then checked the chart as he approached the Bay Bridge. Soon he'd cross over to the eastern side of the channel. He was now checking the boat's clock. He thought of it as a chronometer, at least once a minute.
Pam was a great little fuck. Right up to the end, Billy said, taunting his captor,
filling the silence with his own malignant words, finding a sort of courage there.
Not real smart, though. Not real smart.
Just past the Bay Bridge, Kelly disengaged the autopilot and turned the wheel 10 degrees to port. There was no morning traffic to speak of, but he looked carefully anyway before initiating the maneuver. A pair of running lights just on the horizon announced the approach of a merchant ship, probably 12,000 yards off. Kelly could have flipped on the radar to check, but in these weather conditions it just would have been a waste of electricity.
"Did she tell you about the passion marks?" Billy sneered.
He didn't see Kelly's hands tighten on the wheel. "The marks about the breasts appear to have been made with an ordinary set of pliers," the pathology report had said. Kelly had it all memorized, every single word of the dry medical phraseology, as though engraved with a diamond stylus on a plate of steel. He wondered if the medics had felt the same way he did. Probably so. Their anger had probably manifested itself in the increased detachment of their dictated notes. Professionals were like that.
"She talked, you know. She told us everything. How you picked her up, how you partied. We taught her that, mister. You owe us for that. Before she ran, I bet she didn't tell you. She fucked us all, 3-4 times each. I guess she thought that was pretty smart, eh? I guess she never figured that we'd all get to fuck her some more."
O positive, O negative, AB negative, Kelly thought. Blood type O was by far the most common of all, and so that meant there could well have been more than 3 of them. "And what blood type are you, Billy?"
"Just a whore. A pretty one, but just a fucking little whore. That's how she died, did you know? She died while she was fucking a guy. We strangled her, and her cute little ass was pumping hard right up till the time her face turned purple."
"Funny to watch," Billy assured him with a leer that Kelly didn't have to see.
"I had my fun with her. 3 times, man. I hurt her. I hurt her bad, you hear me?"
Kelly opened his mouth wide, breathing slowly and regularly, not allowing his muscles to tense up now. The morning wind had picked up some, letting the boat rock perhaps 5 degrees left and right of the vertical, and he allowed his body to ride with the rolls, commanding himself to accept the soothing motion of the sea.
"I don't know what the big deal is. I mean, she's just a dead whore. We should be able to cut a deal, like. You know how dumb you are? There were 70 grand back in the house, you dumb son of a bitch. 70 grand!
Billy stopped, seeing it wasn't working. Still, an angry man made mistakes, and he'd rattled the guy before. He was sure of that, and so he continued.
"You know, the real shame, I guess, is she needed drugs. You know, if she just knew another place to score, we never would have seen y'all. Then you fucked up too, remember?"
"Yes, I remember."
"I mean, you really were dumb. Didn't you know about phones? Jesus, man. After our car got stuck, we called Bert and got his car and just went cruising, like. And there you were, easy as hell to spot in that Jeep. You must have really been under her spell, man."
Phones? It was something that simple that had killed Pam, Kelly thought. His muscles went taut. "You fucking idiot, Kelly." Then his shoulders went slack, just for a second, with the realization of how thoroughly he had failed her, and part of him recognized the emptiness of his efforts at revenge. But empty or not, it was something he would have. He sat up straighter in the control chair.
"I mean, shit. Car easy to spot like that. How fucking dumb can a guy be?" Billy asked,
having just seen real feedback from his taunts. Now perhaps he could start real negotiations.
I'm kind of surprised you're alive. Hey, I mean, it wasn't anything personal. Maybe you didn't know the work she did for us. We couldn't let her loose with what she knew, right? I can make it up to you. Let's make a deal, okay?
Kelly checked the autopilot and the surface. Springer was moving on a safe and steady course, and nothing in sight was on a converging path. He rose from his chair and moved to another, a few feet from Billy.
She told you that we were in town to score some drugs?
She told you that? Kelly asked, his eyes level with Billy's.
Yeah, that's right.
Billy was relaxing. He was puzzled when Kelly started weeping in front of him. Perhaps here was a chance to get out of his predicament.
"Geez, I'm sorry, man," Billy said in the wrong sort of voice. "I mean, it's just bad luck for you."
"Bad luck for me." He closed his eyes just a few inches from Billy's face. "Dear God, she was protecting me. Even after I failed her. She didn't even know if I was alive or not, but she lied to protect me." It was more than he could bear, and Kelly simply lost control of himself for several minutes. But even that had a purpose. His eyes dried up after a time, and as he wiped his face, he also removed any human feelings he might have had for his guest. Kelly stood and walked back to the control chair. He didn't want to look the little bastard in the face any longer. He might really lose control, and he couldn't risk that.
"Tom, I think you may be right after all," Ryan said.
According to his driver's license, already checked out, no arrest record, but a lengthy list of traffic violations, Richard Oliver Farmer was 24 and would grow no older. He had expired from a single knife thrust into the chest, through the pericardium, fully transiting the heart. The size of the knife wound, ordinarily such traumatic insults closed up until they became difficult for the layman to see, indicated that the assailant had twisted the blade as much as the space between the ribs allowed. It was a large wound, indicating a blade roughly 2 inches in width. More important, there was additional confirmation.
"Not real smart," the M.E. announced.
Ryan and Douglas, both nodding, looking. Mr. Farmer had been wearing a white cotton button-down collar shirt. There was a suit jacket, too, hanging on a doorknob. Whoever had killed him had wiped the knife on the shirt. 3 wipes, it appeared, and one of them had left a permanent impression of the knife, marked in the blood of the victim, who had a revolver in his belt but hadn't had a chance to use it. Another victim of skill and surprise, but in this case, less circumspection. The junior of the pair pointed to one of the stains with his pencil.
"You know what it is?" Douglas asked.
It was rhetorical. He answered his own question immediately. "It's a K-bar, standard-issue Marine combat knife. I own one myself."
"Nice edge on it, too," the M.E. told them. "Very clean cut, almost surgical in the way it went through the skin. He must have sliced the heart just about in half."
"A very accurate thrust, gentlemen. The knife came in perfectly horizontal, so it didn't jam on the ribs. Most people think the heart's on the left. Our friend knew better. Only one penetration. He knew exactly what he was doing." "One more, Em. Armed criminal. Our friend got in close and did him so fast."
"Yeah, Tom, I believe you now."
Ryan nodded and went upstairs to join the other detective team. In the front bedroom was a pile of men's clothes, a cloth satchel with a ton of cash in it, a gun and a knife. A mattress with semen stains, some still moist. Also a lady's purse. So much evidence for the younger men to catalog. Blood types from the semen stains. Complete ID on all 3, they assumed 3, people who had been there. Even a car outside to run down. Finally, something like a normal murder case. Latent prints would be all over the place. The photographers had already shot a dozen rolls of film. But for Ryan and Douglas, the matter was already settled in its curious way.
"You know that guy Farber over at Hopkins? Yeah, I am. He worked the Gooding case with Frank Allen. I set the date up. He's real smart, Douglas allowed. A little peculiar, but smart. I have to be in court this afternoon, remember?
Okay, I think I can handle it. I owe you a beer, Tom. You figured this one faster than I did.
Well, thanks. Maybe I can be a lieutenant, too, someday.
Ryan laughed, fishing out a cigarette as he walked down the stairs.
You going to resist? Kelly asked with a smile. He'd just come back into the salon after tying up to the key.
Why should I help you with anything? Billy asked with what he thought to be defiance.
Okay.
Kelly drew the K-bar and held it next to a particularly sensitive place.
We can start right now if you want.
The whole body shriveled, but one part more than the others.
Okay, okay.
Good. I want you to learn a little from this. I don't want you ever to hurt another girl again.
Kelly loosed the shackles from the deck fitting, but his arms were still together, bolted in tight, as he stood Billy up.
Fuck you, man! You're gonna kill me! And I ain't gonna tell you shit!
Kelly twisted him around to stare in his eyes. I'm not going to kill you, Billy. You'll leave this island alive. I promise.
The confusion on his face was sufficiently amusing that Kelly actually smiled for a second. Then he shook his head. He told himself that he was treading a very narrow and hazardous path between two equally dangerous slopes, and to both extremes lay madness, of two different types, but equally destructive. He had to detach himself from the reality of the moment, yet hold on to it.
Kelly helped him down from the boat and walked him towards the machinery bunker.
Thirsty?
I need to take a piss, too.
Kelly guided him onto some grass.
Go right ahead.
Kelly waited.
Billy didn't like being naked, not in front of another man, not in a subordinate position. Foolishly, he wasn't trying to talk to Kelly now, at least not in the right way. Coward that he was, he'd tried to build up his manhood earlier, trying to talk not so much to Kelly as himself, as he'd recounted his part in ending Pam's life, creating for himself an illusion of power, when silence might, well, would probably not have saved him. It might have created doubts, though, especially if he'd been clever enough to spin a good yarn. But cowardice and stupidity were not strangers to each other, were they?
Kelly let him stand untended while he dialed the combination lock. Turning on the interior lights, he pushed Billy inside. It looked like, was in fact, a steel cylinder, 17 inches in diameter, sitting on its own legs with large caster wheels at the bottom, just where he'd left it. The steel cover on the end was not in place, hanging down on its hinge.
You're going to get in that, Kelly told him.
Fuck you, man! Defiance again. Kelly used the butt end of the K-bar to club him on the back of the neck. Billy fell to his knees.
One way or another, you're getting in. Bleeding or not bleeding, I really don't care.
Which was a lie, but an effective one. Kelly lifted him by the neck and forced his head and shoulders into the opening.
Don't move.
It was so much easier than he'd expected. Kelly pulled a key off its place on the wall and unbolted the shackles on Billy's hands. He could feel his prisoner tense, thinking that he might have a chance. But Kelly was fast on the wrench. He only had to remove one bolt to free both hands, and a prod from the knife in the right place encouraged Billy not to back up, which was the necessary precursor to any kind of effective resistance. Billy was just too cowardly to accept pain as the price for a chance at escape. He trembled, but didn't resist at all, for all his lavish and desperate thoughts.
Inside.
A push helped, and when his feet were inside the rim, Kelly lifted the hatch and bolted it into place. Then he walked out, flipping the lights off. He needed something to eat and a nap. Billy could wait. The waiting would just make things easier.
Hello?
Her voice sounded very worried.
Hi, Sandy, it's John.
John! What's going on?
How is she?
Doris, you mean?
She's sleeping now, Sandy told him.
John, who... I mean, what's happened to her?
Kelly squeezed the phone receiver in his hand.
Sandy, I want you to listen to me very carefully, okay? This is really important.
Okay, go ahead.
Sandy was in her kitchen looking at a pot of coffee. Outside, she could see neighborhood children playing a game of ball on a vacant field whose comforting normality now seemed to be very distant indeed.
Number one, don't tell anybody that she's there.
Sure as hell you don't tell the police.
John, she's badly injured. She's hooked on pills. She probably has severe medical problems on top of that. I have to...
Sam and Sarah, then. Nobody else.
Sandy, you got that?
Nobody else.
Sandy...
Kelly hesitated. It was too hard a thing to say, but he had to make it clear.
Sandy, I have placed you in danger. The people who worked Doris over are the same ones...
I know, John. I kind of figured that one out.
The nurse's expression was neutral, but she too had seen the photo of Pamela Starr Madden's body.
John, she told me that you... killed somebody.
Yes, Sandy, I did. Sandra O'Toole wasn't surprised. She'd made the right guesses a few hours before, but hearing it from him, it was the way he'd just said it. Calm, matter-of-fact.
Yes, Sandy, I did.
Did you take the garbage out?
Yes, Sandy, I did.
Sandy, these are some very dangerous people. I could have left Doris behind, but I couldn't, could I?
Jesus, Sandy, did you see what they...
Yes.
It had been a long time since she'd worked the ER, and she'd almost forgotten the dreadful things that people did to one another.
Sandy, I'm sorry that I...
John, it's done. I'll handle it, okay?
Kelly stopped talking for a moment, taking strength from her voice. Perhaps that was the difference between them. His instinct was to lash out, to identify the people who did the evil things and to deal with them. Seek out and destroy. Her instinct was to protect in a different way, and it struck the former SEAL that her strength might well be the greater.
I'll have to get her proper medical attention.
Sandy thought about the young woman upstairs in the back bedroom. She'd helped her get cleaned off and been horrified at the marks on her body, the vicious physical abuse. But worst of all were her eyes, dead, absent of the defiant spark that she saw in patients even as they lost their fight for life. Despite years of work in the care of critically ill patients, she'd never realized that a person could be destroyed on purpose, through deliberate, sadistic malice. Now she might come to the attention of such people herself, Sandy knew, but greater than her fear for them was her loathing. For Kelly, those feelings were precisely inverted.
Okay, Sandy, but please be careful. Promise me.
I will. I'm going to call Dr. Rosen. She paused for a moment.
John?
Yes, Sandy.
What you're doing...
It's wrong, John. She hated herself for saying that.
I know, Kelly told her.
Sandy closed her eyes, still seeing the kids chasing a baseball outside, then seeing John, wherever he was, knowing the expression that had to be on his face. She knew she had to say the next part, too, and she took a deep breath.
But I don't care about that. Not anymore.
I understand, John.
Thank you. Kelly whispered.
Are you okay?
I'll do fine.
I'll be back as soon as I can. I don't know what we can do with her.
Let me worry about that. We'll take care of her. We'll come up with something.
Okay, Sandy.
Sandy?
What, John?
Thanks.
The line clicked off.
You're welcome, she thought, hanging up.
What a strange man. He was killing people, ending the lives of fellow human beings, doing it with an utter ruthlessness that she hadn't seen, had no desire to see, but which his voice proclaimed in its emotionless speech. But he'd taken the time and endangered himself to rescue Doris.
She still didn't understand, Sandy told herself, dialing the phone again.
Dr. Sidney Farber looked exactly as Emmett Ryan expected.